Thank you very much to Cathy and to Noel as the chairs of SCOTUNS, and to Ema and to Tricia for all their help getting here and the arrangements for the conference, and for the generous introduction then from Cathy. That is actually true. They gave a PhD student the task of introducing me at a conference in Australia in July, and I said that I would give her a prize if she made up something really imaginative. And I was a podiatrist. She did actually introduce me as a podiatrist, but I'm not a podiatrist, and I've never been to Skibbereen, and I'm not a pilot either. So, but I will, Cathy's indicated, you might have guessed where I'm coming from some of those titles, actually, which is something I didn't know Cathy was going to do. Oh. Brilliant. Thank you very much. So I've been a teacher, educator, and researcher for 20 years now. I was a school teacher and an English teacher before that, so you might have guessed that from the titles of some of those publications. And I've been on both sides of change processes. So one of the first things I was asked to do when I came into the university sector in England was to be part of a project called Supporting Assessment for the Award of QTS. I think they chose me because I was young and naive. And this was the Teacher Training Agency, as it was called in England at the time, that it was charged with producing exemplification materials for national standards for teachers. So we have this thing called QTS, Qualified Teacher Status. And my job was to work with teachers in North London and a video crew. Their other job was to work on the Food Channel, interestingly. So they were used to filming people cooking, and then they had to learn how to film people eating and teaching, rather. And I was involved in that project, and it was supposed to be quite a short one, but it lasted a long time, and I'll mention that. I've also been involved in research projects in the US, the UK, China, and Norway, funded by different people, that have led to this book, which is available from all good booksellers, as well as Amazon. Creating a department. So one of the things I think is really important is if you are sort of committed to this kind of work, you know, you've been a teacher, you are a teacher educator, you do research in the field, it's probably incumbent on us all then to step forward at times and to take leadership positions. I feel very strongly about that. So my time came with quite a challenge, actually, which was to reopen a Department of Education at Brunel University in West London. So it had been a department when Brunel opened in 1967, and then it had slowly got amalgamated into different other formations, and it was part of a school of sport and education when I arrived. So my job was to kind of create it again as a distinctive department or a distinct department. And of course, in England, we have those wonderful Ofsted risks attached to teacher education. So my 3 years were risk management, entirely around our research excellence framework, research productivity, most of the staff being teacher educators, and also Ofsted, the accountability risks in terms of quality. I work in Norway in a university, but I also work on the side of the reformers. So if I go to Norway as part of this project, people complain to me and say, oh, you want us to change what we do. That's a bad thing, you know. And then the civil servants will say to them, yes, but we're going to give you these tens of millions of kroner to make it easier for you. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, I wish that would happen elsewhere when people were asked to do a major change in the way that you do teacher education, that it would be as well supportive and as consultative. So later this month, I go up to Tromsø, the University of the Arctic, and on 2 days, we've got 49 people from schools and from the local communes or the local districts authorities, as well as teacher educators, and the point of those is to be consultative and deliberative, and it's all fully funded, and you may also know that Norway has put 150 teacher educators through fully funded full-time PhDs. So Norway, as some other countries are in Europe, is an interesting case because it's totally committed to changing teacher education, but it's changing it in a different way. I have some experience in Ireland. It's been interesting. Before I was at QUB, as part of a really formative experience for me, an examining team that include people like Margaret Cox and Jane Jones, and I was actually the English and religious education examiner, and we went all over the north. And then currently I'm at St. Angela's College as an external examiner there, which I, again, am finding really interesting. And that's because of the nature of St. Angela's. That's taken me to Dublin to do school visits and so on. I'm involved in these projects, which are to do with changing the way we do teacher education at King's, and also at Teachers College. They've recognised that they want to produce a doctoral degree that will prepare and equip people to become teacher educators. There's a very high profile on the preparation of teacher educators in the US, and it's being done by private organisations as well as by universities. But the Educating the Teacher Educators project at Teachers College, again, has been really formative for me, because it's asked questions about what do advanced students who are also expert practitioners need to know in order to better prepare the next generation of school teachers. And that's led us now to forming a joint centre for innovation in teacher education and development, CITED. And there's a lot of practical work involved in that. And again, you know, that's a leadership role. There's an intellectual dimension to it, and you also have to roll your sleeves up and get down to it. But the intellectual dimension to it is really thinking through what we mean by innovation. What do we mean by innovation in relation to concepts like change and reform? I'm going to mention things that I've written. I think Kathy may have found this already. I have a little website, and that's the address at the bottom. And if you're interested, you can follow up. I can't put everything on there, because otherwise the publishers and everybody would get onto me. But there are some things on there, including the manuscript copies of things that you can get hold of. And what I'm going to talk about today for about 45 minutes, and maybe then question. Do you want to have questions immediately afterwards, Kathy, or do you want to go straight into the panel? Okay. Yeah, that's fine. So, what I've done is I've taken some of the words in the theme and the call for this particular conference, which I'm calling keywords. I'm taking that from someone called Raymond Williams, which I'll talk about in a minute. And so what I'm going to do in a moment is to talk about three keywords: innovation, reform, and evidence. And then I'm going to respond in more detail to two questions, really. One of which is, what do we mean by evidence? What are the uses of evidence, and what do we in teacher education perhaps need to know and be better at in terms of evidence? And the second question is reform. How does that position us, and how might we respond to imperatives for change called reform in ways that we're happy with and that we think are best for the children in the schools who are the eventual, to use the language, end users of the practitioners and the professionals that we're producing. So just quickly to gloss that, Raymond Williams was a cultural critic, a kind of one of the leading figures in the development of cultural studies in the UK, starting in literature, moved into adult education, and the book that he wrote in 1976, published in 76, took what he called keywords and then kind of just interrogated them. These were words at the time that were, in the way that he described it, they bind us together. We all use these words, so to that extent they're key because of their frequency in everyday discourse. But they're also those frequently used words where you can come up very sharp because you have a very different understanding of its meaning compared to the person next to you, or to the person on the other side of the room. So these keywords have a kind of two parts to them. They are, yes, everyday binding words. If you're interested in social policy or education policy, you know, innovation, evidence, reform are part of the lexicon, But what we mean by those can be very different, and it's worth interrogating those meanings, William said, in order to better understand, have purchase on them, take control of them. And it's through that that you're likely, through the consciousness of the problematics of meaning of these words, you're able to develop your own agency in responding to the problems. In terms of the book at the time, the only word that I'm going to mention, talk about today, that he had in his book originally was reform. He had reform in keywords. He didn't have evidence, and he didn't have innovation as keywords. He did use the word innovation and evidence in the other parts of the book. So what I've done is I've gone to other sources and I've developed my kind of own understanding in relation to these words. And I do recommend the book. And I also recommend a website which is produced by an American academic called John Patrick Leary. Obviously, he has some a cultural heritage there, I think. And he's got Keywords for the Age of Austerity. Very, very interesting web-based collection of essays about words. So I've drawn a little on John Patrick Leary's work as well. So innovation as a noun and as a verb, and you see in its history this kind of double action. You see both this action of introducing new elements or forms. You see, as Leary points out, an explosion of popularity since the 60s. So he uses databases, of a corpus linguistics database, to look at how these words figure, and innovation explodes after that. But if you look at the earlier history, innovation was actually something in the 17th century you weren't supposed to do. It was about breaking away from rules and routines and established norms and so on. But it gets to the point, especially by the time you get to our century, and a kind of key article by Evgeny Mozarov in the New Republic, where it's become a bit of a fetish. It's a word that we use all the time without necessarily understanding what it means. And it's almost the implication you have to be interested in it. And if you're not interested in it, you're backward-looking and you're conservative. So the word is really important in terms of pinning down its meaning in relation to where we are now. It's important, I think, too, to make the distinction between invention or creativity in a creative act and innovation, which is exploitation or capitalization. So in other words, you can do something creative, you can have a really good idea, but if it doesn't actually have, to use another keyword, impact, if it doesn't become institutionalized in practices, then it remains at the level of a good idea. It hasn't had any value created, you haven't exploited it. And that's an interesting one. And of course, you've already telling when you use a word like capitalization, there's a kind of economic discourse behind this as well. But it does have a tradition in the early 21st century of thinking about what innovation means in the public sector. So innovation in the public sector is about exploiting good ideas to create public value. So the OECD and people like Dadlio and so on have written well about that. The best kind of discussion of that kind of public sector innovation, the exploitation of good ideas to enhance human capabilities, to extend democracy, and to build society is in this book by Raijo Maitinen from Helsinki University, Innovation, Human Capabilities, and Democracy Towards an Enabling Welfare State. And it's a view of innovation that does have an economic dimension. We need to produce economic resources, okay? So we need to get ourselves out of financial crises. But the reason that we do that is we need to rebuild society. And Maitinen's book is really interesting because this book was published by Oxford University Press in its politics and business kind of list. The key case study in it is the Finnish school system. And whereas you get a lot of, I think, at times quite superficial writing about the Finnish school system, Maitinen goes back to the Second World War, and he particularly focuses on the period from 1960 onwards, where the Finnish government was building the Finnish nation. It had to be more economically productive, but the reason it wanted to be more economically productive was to make a better society for people. And the last time I attended a Scotans conference was in Limerick, and I don't know whether she's still education minister, but I think I heard the Republic's education minister make just the same kind of point. The reason that we want to get out of the financial crisis is not just to get out of a financial crisis. The reason we want to get out of a financial crisis is to rebuild our society. The reason that we want to become kind of viable financially, economically, is to ensure that there's a really good community, and the school is an important part of that. However, in English, the word innovation is one that is inflected primarily through economic and technological discourses. And I want to talk about the two of those there. So to go back to Joseph Schumpeter, who was an Austrian economist, actually came from a place that's now in Czechoslovakia, and he argued that innovation was the main driver of economic change. And the concept that he came up with was creative destruction. So creative destruction, he maintained, was actually the engine of economic change. You have to destroy the market that currently exists in order to create new markets. So Schumpeter's argument was different to most of the kind of arguments at the time, which focused on competition, price competition and choice, and Schumpeter focused on innovation. He focused on what he called creative destruction, creatively destroying what came before. And of course, the arena in which that has become most popularized has been in technology. So Clayton Christensen, whose most famous book, I think, is The Innovator's Dilemma, has talked and written, including in the public sector context as well, about disruptive technologies and their relationships to incumbent organizations. So schools and universities are incumbent organizations. You know, they tend to have lots of capital, they have lots of people, they're able to produce economies of scale because of the way that they are. But new technologies can really disrupt the way that they operate. And Christensen distinguished between two types of innovation. The first was what he called a sustaining innovation. So that's incremental change to products or services in response to market feedback. And in some way, although the language wasn't used in the book, it's analogous to the action research cycle. You try something, you get a feedback loop going, you try it again. It's a kind of about incremental change. The other kind that he distinguished was disruptive innovation. It creates new markets. So you don't try to refine the Betamax video cassette. You do not try to refine the C90 audio cassette. You try to develop new media devices. And the whole idea is you put those other people out of business. Now, just in case we think we're going down an economic alley, the quotation on the right from Michael Gove, who was one of the most interesting education secretaries, and that's an understatement, that England's had for a very long time, he fully immersed in this language of disruptive innovation. Fully immersed in it. And we shouldn't just attribute it to the Conservatives or the Coalition either. So was Tony Blair. So was Peter Mandelson. So were those Labour ministers in our government from 97. So this whole idea about you need to change things in important ways, and the way that the only way that you're going to do that is by being disruptive. And that's a challenge to the way we sometimes think about policy, because we expect policy to be thought through, planned, maybe piloted, but we shouldn't be surprised if the design of policymaking is one in which a pilot is anathema. You don't want to test, you want to shake. If the end purpose is to shake things up, to create new markets, to try to get change, then that's the aim. The aim isn't to have one viable plan. And of course, it is related to this idea of reform. So reform, and this is one word that Raymond Williams did write about in Keywords, Reform from the time it came into English in the 14th century had these kind of double meanings. So there's a meaning that's about restoring things to their original form, and there's a meaning about making something new. And sometimes that's indicated by the emphasis on the prefix re, reform. And of course it's also related to ideas that are in religion and so on about reformation. So there's sometimes echoes or overtones of purification and so on. But this double meaning about restoring original ideas and creating something new. And I think, and this isn't Williams here, but I think you see different traditions of reform, even though, again, the word is used in a contemporary world after Williams's death. And I think you do see a kind of Anglo-American, what Stephen Ball calls a global education reform movement, germ model of reform. And that's got those, both the neoliberal, that's the kind of market-based solutions to, you know, wicked problems, but also the neoconservative approach, which is actually if we could just restore things to the way they were and do that well, then things will be much better. So there's a cultural restorationism involved in the Anglo-American version of reform, as well as a kind of marketization, privatization thing. And I would also say, given the influence of the English language, there's also a kind of colonial intent to this as well. There's a colonial intent to this movement as it travels around the world. That's not to say that it works in the way that the promoters intend, because when an Anglo-American English language idea lands in Guangzhou province in China, they will make their own sense of it. So it's not to say there's a deterministic approach to it, but that kind of traveling idea based on these kind of Anglo-American traditions of reform are really quite predominant. But there is another way. And over the last 10 years, really, I've been working in Norway and working with people who are from the Netherlands and also from Denmark and Sweden and Finland and so on. And you get another tradition, and it's not an English language tradition. It's a tradition in which reform is part of this virtuous cycle. Virtuous both again in that kind of religious sense, but increasingly in a kind of economic sense too. So in this kind of model of reform, we want to change the way we educate teachers, says Norway, yeah, which is doing right at the minute. Big reform in Norway starting this year. But it's based on a kind of historical settlement, which is that the teaching profession is entitled to relative autonomy. It's based on a settlement that says the teacher unions are important parts of a representational process in that. So when we deliberate reform, we have to include them. And that universities are really important societal engines for positive change. So it's a distinct political economic settlement in which words like profession and university have a very different kind of meaning. Both of these reform traditions respond to things like PISA measurements, but they have a different understanding of economics, and they have a different understanding of what we hear all the time as a knowledge economy. Okay, evidence. So, it's a noun and a verb. I hate it as a verb. I don't know, I think because I'm so imbued in teacher education practice, the use of this as a verb, you need to evidence your achievement against the standards, actually still makes me feel quite sick, because what that inevitably leads to is the production of bureaucracy and paperwork and wheelbarrows full of files, trying to put little aspects of practice into written form and then to file these under 33 separate headings. So the use of the verb to evidence makes me feel really uncomfortable. But it's interesting, again, and this wasn't in Williams's keywords, it's interesting to look at where this word comes from evidentia, to be evident, clear to the eye or to the mind. So it's not a kind of question of fact or data or information. It's something that's clear to you. You can see it is clear. Yeah? And in law and in rhetoric, the notion of evidence has very important meanings, I think, for us. One, there's the question of proof, yeah, which is to do with argument, and that's to do with substantiation, and that's to do with persuasion. And of course, we then end up with these concepts that are really important when we think about change, reform, and innovation. Evidence-based practice. Yep. And that's a really interesting concept that, again, you can trace in terms of the use of that phrase to the frequency increasing in about 1992, but it comes from Cochrane's work from the early 70s in relation to medicine, evidence-based medicine. And Cochrane contrasted evidence-based medicine with tradition. So you've got evidence-based medicine or tradition, evidence-based practice versus practitioner judgment, even quackery. So, you know, I don't feel very well, I've got a bit of a toothache, let me put a bit of string around your tooth and tie it to a door handle and slam the door, and that'll see you all right. The quackery idea is there in terms of a lack of trust of a professional group. Yeah, and part of that is a good thing in terms of professionals being more democratically accountable. We wouldn't want a situation where teachers, doctors, nurses, or anyone else could do things entirely as they pleased without behind closed doors. You know, a degree of transparency and accountability in a democracy is a vital thing. But it's a question of judgment about this relationship between a body of evidence and how it's produced and professional practice, judgment, wisdom, and so on. And Cochrane's argument was that the most reliable form of evidence in medicine came from randomized control trials, RCTs, and he was an epidemiologist, so he was interested in what this meant for whole populations. Yeah. So if you've got this little bleb on the side of your head, as I had this summer just here, and there, the randomized control trial information says that actually for that kind of thing, we're not going to do a detailed investigation that involves a biopsy or anything like that. We're not going to find out what it is, right? I'm not going to talk to you and ask you questions and get you to elaborate in a narrative sense. I'm going to look at that, and the best way of dealing with it is exactly as happened to me. Send me down the corridor to sister, who lay me down on a bed and whipped it out. And then they did the biopsy. So that kind of, you know, that's the best way. And there's something about cost efficiency too, because I'm in the building and they've got the specialists in the building. They can make this work well. And it sort of worked, but that's another story. We also have this idea of evidence-based policy. So the idea that if you get the best evidence, you'll get better policy. And Justin Parkhurst has just produced an absolutely fantastic book. The title is on the next slide, which unusually for whole books is open access. So you can Google the title of the book when I give it to you in a minute. You can get the whole book published by Routledge free of charge. And it's about evidence-based policymaking. And Parkhurst comes from healthcare and particularly from HIV education. But so much of what he writes is relevant to other aspects of social policy and education policy. So he draws our attention to what, you know, you might call a rather naive view, which is that some social policies can somehow be based on evidence alone. But actually, the much more recent thinking is that public policy making is not technical decision making. Policy making involves trade-offs between multiple competing social values, with only a very small proportion of public policy decisions concerned with the technical evidence to the effects of interventions. And he also produces, that's the title of the book, called The Politics of Evidence, a very interesting table and discussion in one of his chapters about technical bias and issue bias in the creation, the selection, and the interpretation of evidence. And some of that will be familiar to us in terms of cherry picking, for example. You know, if you want to prove a point, provide evidence to win an argument, you will make selections. But Parkhurst makes some really good points about how bias is built in right from the start in one kind of research, one kind of evidence-producing process. And I think that will be relevant to what I'm going to come on to next. Before I go on, though, I would say there are two words here that are also are key words. And at the moment, I'm working on a new book, and amongst the other than the three I've just mentioned, these words are really important. Profession. What does it mean for teaching to be a profession? And there's a long history of those kinds of questions. But also, what does it mean for a university or a college to be a higher education institution? And we're familiar with that in one sense because we live it and we lived changes to higher education, and St. Angela's is more than aware of that in terms of its position with the National University of Ireland. But there are much deeper questions about the kind of work that gets valued in both places, the kind of relationships to autonomy that people have in both places. So I think those are words that we haven't dealt with, and I haven't dealt with, but that we should. Okay, so to go back to these points that I wanted to make, and this is deriving from the way that evidence is understood, not only in our field, but others, evidence being contestable and functioning rhetorically. You know, have you got a good argument? Have you marshaled the right arguments? I think this PowerPoint will go on the Scoton's website, and when, if you're interested, you can click on this link, and you'll get a little clip from a British TV program called 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown. And you'll hear a comedian called Joe Lycett, and Joe Lycett will explain to you how he actually got his parking fine cancelled. Okay, it's a lovely clip because it's about evidence. It's about how you construct evidence to win an argument, and as a result of his construction of the evidence, the council that issued the parking fine cancelled the parking fine. Okay, so to go back to the question of evidence in education, in teacher education, this is related to that project I told you about when I first came in, and I think they chose me because they thought that I would be naive, compliant, malleable. No, he's got loads of energy, let him go on and do this. 4 years later, I was bald, virtually. Collaborative judgment. So what was really interesting about this was we filmed for a week in a classroom in North London with an outstanding, in every way, English teacher. We made selections of the videotape. We prepared how those long chunks of video would relate to these teachers' standards. And then we sent these packages, and they were actually on VHS tapes at the time. That's how quickly things have changed. We sent these VHS tapes around. We gave them to a sample of teacher educators in England, and we gave them to the subject associations, NATE and UKLA, and no one agreed. No one at all agreed. But what it did, you know, is this good English teaching? Is this good literacy teaching? Does this meet this particular standard? Massive debate. So that kind of, what it did show was that in order to get a kind of a sense of standard, you needed some kind of deliberation, a public deliberation. You couldn't exemplify it through snatches of video and little bits of writing. So even within our field, even within the field of teacher education in English and literacy, we could not agree on what constituted good evidence of meeting these teacher standards. Colleen yesterday mentioned the Academies program in England. The Academies program was different under New Labour as it is under the Conservatives. The purpose under New Labour was to take what were deemed to be failing schools and convert them with sponsors. And the coalition conservative one is basically everything's got to become an academy. The chain effects study has been produced every year now since 2014 by the Sutton Trust. And there are actually very few academies that have the intended effect on outcomes of poor children. And you look at the whole data set, there's no difference between academies or local authority maintained schools. So you then get, you know, you're able to show that and say, okay, here's this evidence and it's a bit problematic for this as a policy, and you'll get the answer back, actually, that's just the wrong data, yeah? The point was not that these were going to be a universal panacea, but there was going to be, at least implicitly and potentially, freedom for the schools to improve themselves in the kinds of way that Colleen was mentioning yesterday in terms of London Challenge. So you can present pretty robust data that a particular policy has not worked on the terms that it was intended to, but you'll just get an answer back to tell you it's the wrong data. You'll also get an answer back that in spite of the data, this is a good idea. So Teach First in England, according to our National Audit Office, is the most expensive route into teaching. It costs about three times as much to produce a Teach First teacher as it does to produce one that goes through the university system. That's just on a pure kind of cost calculation basis. The other part of the calculation they did was how long do they then stay around? They don't stay around for as long as the ones that produced universities. But actually, that's not the point. The point is we like the policy. We like the policy because we like what Teach First is doing. Teach First is disrupting things. It's an interesting question because then, of course, Teach First, at the scale it's run in England now, is essentially a franchise. You bid for a contract. So the universities are actually delivering Teach First. So it's a very complicated picture, but Teach First is delivering, although not on a kind of cost benefits thing. It's delivering because it's the right kind of policy to stimulate change. Grammar schools. Yeah, so Theresa May introduced that following her surprise election to number 10. And then, thanks to the word that begins with a B, that's fallen off the agenda. So thanks to Brexit, and yesterday we heard some really important points made about the importance of working through cross-border relations at the time that this thing is happening. It's fallen off the agenda. It's fallen off the agenda for pure pragmatic realpolitik reasons. There aren't enough civil servants. They haven't got enough civil servants to staff the department for leaving the EU, never mind the education department, to make this kind of work. But again, you know, loads of academics and teacher unions that came back, and selection does not do what you want it to do. If you think selection is an engine of social mobility, here's a range of evidence, historical evidence. Here's a range of current evidence within England. No, it didn't matter at the time because that wasn't the point. The point was, again, to be disruptive and to send a signal about schools being academically selective in order to enhance social mobility. And then we also get Ofsted inspections within England. And what's interesting about that, they've been happening since 97. So they inspect schools, but they also inspect universities. Every time we get inspected in universities in England, we do well. So they change the framework and make it more demanding. And then we do well. So they change the framework and make it more demanding. And we're now in a two-cycle or two-stage process where they come one year to check that the training is good and the quality of the teaching of your student teachers are good. And then they leave you, and then the inspectors come back in the autumn term and they find a sample of your student teachers in their first jobs. And they check how well are they teaching in their first jobs. And we've even done well with that. So, you know, you can have really good evidence that's produced by the state. And you could say that one of the intentions here was to improve what universities did, but even when universities did improve what they did, it was ratcheted up again. And the implication for many, which I think is reasonable, was that the English government's never been particularly happy with universities being involved in teacher education. So evidence, politics, policy making, not scientific method. Data is not necessarily evidence. Evidence really does function rhetorically. So I think the implications for us as teacher educators within our field, we do need to develop a better understanding of policy making as a complex political activity. I think you have it much better than, you understand that much better than we do in England, north and south here. I think we probably, though, internationally, wherever we're located, need to become more rhetorically adept in our field. And that starts with beginning this, that we have to understand we've got to persuade people. And I think the people that we're not good at persuading generally are the public, because we try to persuade policymakers in a kind of two-way dyadic thing. They say one thing, we say no. We say change, we say really. But actually, we've never really gone wider than that and explained to people what the value might be of a higher education component to teacher education. So I think understanding we've got to do that, and understanding that evidence isn't necessarily persuasive, even if its mode of production has got great methodological rigor. You know, you might have done really detailed statistical analysis or something, or even an RCT, but if that's not going to fit within the social values of your policymakers, if that's not a part of their priorities, you're just going to get into an extended argument. But I suppose at least the extended argument is better than what's sometimes happened in England, which is that teacher educators very defensively have just gone, no, that's it then. Okay, so how does this reform movement position us in universities in teacher education? And how we fall into the trap of the reform movements, and that's rather depressing, I think. Here's an example of a reformer really going it on the web. Okay, so this is a guy who now works for the Arc Academy school chain that's about to open a private university in England. At the time he wrote this, he was employed by Teach First in England, and he said here that the whole of Sweden is characterized by false ideas, weak training, and limited support. I have not yet heard of anyone preparing teachers in Sweden to actually teach. I would love to have this refuted. Like a fool, I tried to refute it. Like a fool, I engaged in a Twitter debate with him. And what he came back with, oh, well, actually, no, because what they don't do in Sweden is this one particular view of how you prepare teachers, which is the practice turn, the American version, kind of most associated with people like Deborah Ball and Pamela Grossman. They don't do that in Sweden, to which my answer was, well, you didn't say that. But actually, that, you know, that wasn't the point. The point was to set the problem here, and the problem in this particular case was to create an inroad for Teach First in Sweden. So at the moment he was writing this, Teach First was moving into Sweden, and it had to create a need, it had to create a problem that needed to be addressed. So reformers have this thing that's sometimes called the problem formulation privilege. And you can come back again with arguments and evidence and so on, but they're setting the terms of the argument. So that kind of approach has paved the way in the US and now in England for these things called the Independent Graduate Schools of Education, the GSEs. Yeah? The most famous one in the US is Relay. Relay is now, it started in New York, it's now kind of spread out across many of the metropolitan areas. It's a private teacher education provider, initial and also continuing professional development, that was originally allowed by the New York State Board of Education to award master's degrees. So at the minute in England, we have the Arc Academy chain about to open the Institute for Teaching, and the Institute for Teaching will benefit from our Higher Education Act 2017 that allows new universities and higher education providers to open up more quickly and with less oversight. So the Institute for Teaching will be open next year, and it will recruit students. It'll probably undercut traditional universities, but it will award them a master's degree without the need for them to collaborate with any other university. Ken Zeichner, in the US context, has done an extremely thorough literature review looking for evidence of the warrant for these claims that the independent graduate schools of education do a better job than universities. And you can see from the title of his report for the National Education Policy Center, the claims are apocryphal and the evidence is illusory. Doesn't matter, really. But what's interesting, and is sometimes ignored, I think, is a really critical consideration. That all of these movements that we've talked about, Teach First, ARC, Relay, Institute for Teaching, you can characterize them, if you like, as broadly neoliberal reform movements, but their claims are inflected through discourses of equality and social justice. So none of these people are saying we want to come into the teacher education market to increase our profits. We're not saying we want to come in to kind of make more money. They're saying they want to come in because universities traditionally have not done a good job in producing teachers who can narrow the attainment gap between poor kids and rich kids. And that's really important because I think very often in education particularly, we fling this neoliberal word around just to describe something we don't like. And I think it's probably really important for us to start to work through what is a neoliberal set of commitments to equality and the argument there is you're more likely to get equality, you're more likely to get access to justice of all kinds if you have services delivered through markets. That's the argument. The argument isn't because they just want to make a profit, although that would be nice. But we've got to address that understanding because my feeling is very often we don't make those arguments ourselves. And so it is a reminder that neoliberalism, if you want to call it that, is interested in these concepts too, and it does have its own arguments, even if we don't. So this reform position, I think, and it's sometimes called 2.0, the 2.0 teacher education or teacher quality position. The book here is by Hessen McShane. I think the best argument there is around teacher education comes in the chapter by Billy Gastick that you have there. And she calls the chapter Teacher Preparation 2.0. And this is the kind of main terms of her argument. And drawing on these ideas of disruptive innovation or creative destruction. Not just to make profits, but to do a better job for poor children. Historical institutions such as faculties of education universities have, first of all, failed to produce enough teachers in many parts of the world, especially STEM subjects. So teacher preparation as a field must be subject to disruptive innovation by private providers in a deregulated marketplace. Because private providers can harness new technologies, reduce costs, increase accountability, and create new revenue-generating opportunities. In this paradigm, student attainment on tests is that essential outcome of teaching. It's not about character, it's not about humane education. And then within this paradigm, there is a practice turn. And we've heard about that talked, I think Noel talked about that yesterday as well, a practice turn. And that comes in two respects, really. One is the kind of very methodologically rigorous version, which is Deborah Ball and Teaching Works. So these are the things that class teachers do that produce the greatest effect size, high leverage instructional practices. And then the kind of anecdotal, more casually observational thing, Teach Like a Champion by Doug Lamov. These are the things that Doug Lamov noticed highly effective teachers did in his schools, and he itemized 62 moves, one of which is strong voice. Can you get to the back of the room with your voice? So we're going to spend a day now in our new private provider, and we're going to teach you how to project your voice, and then tomorrow we'll move on to number two, which is how to hand out leaflets quickly. Not joking, because you need to do that in order to get pace, yep? So in this model, teaching's reframed as leadership, and leadership is advanced as a kind of solution. Okay, so this is my view, and this comes from the book that I've mentioned here. We then tend to fall into a trap, a defensive trap. We say things like, we're universities, don't you know? We've been around for a long time, and we're likely to be around even longer. We get teachers to reflect, which I think is incredibly patronizing. You know, teachers do not need someone with a PhD to drive for 4 hours to get them to reflect. As happens in England, as happens in Ireland, as happens in Norway, as happens wherever, you know. Teachers, given the right support and conditions, can reflect on their own. So I find that one very patronizing. We introduce theories teachers wouldn't otherwise know about. Yes, that might be true, but they might not be very good theories. So, you know, you get reactions to things like learning styles. Why are teacher education providers teaching learning styles, if indeed they are? But so there's a debate about whether it's a good or a bad one. We provide beginning teachers with access to cutting-edge research and cutting-edge researchers. Internationally, if you do a teacher education program, you're not likely to come into contact with a cutting-edge researcher. You are much more likely to come into contact with someone doing their PhD. Right at the bottom of the scale of academic work, trying to move their way up at the same time as they are driving, visiting, supervising, writing notes, and so on. The people who are the cutting-edge researchers, if you like, are usually in another part of the building. And that's something that Jane McNichol and I found in our study, but it's true in the US through the work of Dan Liston. It was true in Canada through the work of Sandra Acker and Joanne Dillaber. True in Australia through the work of Mari Brennan and Joss Nuttall. This is an international phenomenon. Look at Finland, okay, but actually we don't look at Finland anymore because we can't afford to give teachers master's degrees in England, and Finland has kind of slipped from its PISA position. And then the final justification is we have clinical practice, which seems to mean we have placements or practicums. Now, I'm not quite sure what that's got to do with the university other than they allow their students out. But I've never found these arguments particularly convincing. It's a very defensive position, in my view. So in this book, Jane and I, on the basis of a couple of studies to do with rhetoric and discourse of how universities talk about teacher educators, as well as a year-long kind of study of 13 teacher educators from an ethnographic perspective across England and Scotland. And interestingly, we didn't notice any great differences between England and Scotland, even though Scotland is often held up as a better place for teacher education than England. We found things like this when universities in England and Scotland advertised for teacher educators. On the one side, there's something there that's completely lacking in anything to do with academic work. We need an excellent communicator with a positive approach for this exciting role in our challenging environment. Now, if you're sensitive to language, there's code there, and it's not very nice, actually. It says, come and work in a difficult place. And on the other side, when we spoke to a dean in an old university, he just found himself in a very difficult place. You cannot expect someone who spent a lifetime teaching in schools to have also built a research profile. And there's the complete lack of understanding of how you can support people who have been school teachers, the vast majority of teacher educators in many contexts around the world, to become research active. We found these were the kinds of dimensions to the job of educating. You'll recognize some of them: managing courses, doing recruitment, examining at other institutions, marking, and so on and so forth. Yeah, but we found that the most defining characteristic was something we called relationship maintenance. So people were driving around with Bluetooth connections, trying to manage relationships in a partnership model of teacher education in England, partnership model, mandated by law, yeah, from 1992 and then reinforced from 1997. They were trying to repair relationships, maintain relationships, but they were doing very, very little research. And the case studies at the core of our book really bring that out. So we noticed things that we call the proletarianization of teacher educators within this classed system of university education departments, under this phenomenon which we haven't invented, but other people like Sheila Slaughter and Gary Rhodes called academic capitalism. To thrive in the university, you need to get grants, write papers, get citations, win fellowships, and so on. You accumulate academic capital. If you work in teacher education, that's structurally much harder for you to do. However important your work is, however essential it is to keep the system going, however essential it is to get the right number of teachers, you are actually going to find it harder. We say in the book that we think this weakens the discipline of education. We think that it presents an existential crisis, actually, for the professional preparation of teachers. And in case many countries think that if only they had partnership, if they only had mentoring going on with schools, that it would be a lot better, the evidence from our study and other studies is it doesn't. It raises as many problems as it seems to address. John Furlong comes to a similar but slightly different diagnosis in his book, which is about education as a discipline. And so I'm just going to finish with, well, what can we do? And this is where I'm going to flick through these things. You might ask me questions, but also there are things you can download. So Jane and I took a position which we called a transform position. It's something we've talked with Ken Zeichner about. That is Ken Zeichner's head on the top of a transformer. And it was like, okay, we don't want to go into the reform line, but neither do we want to be defensive. We actually want to think about how we change the way teachers are prepared in a non-defensive, transformative way to try to kind of break out of this kind of dichotomy between reforming and then defending your position. And in the book, we end with some principles. This is one. Rather than thinking about partnership, maybe we can think about the relationship between HE and the profession as the co-configuration of new forms of activity, new forms of subject teaching, new forms of primary school teaching, rather than structural partnerships and channels of communication. You have people in the professional setting, expert teachers or developing experts or would-be experts. What's the contribution of universities to supporting those people? And we describe it using some cultural historical theory language as co-configuration. It's a different thing. The fifth principle is that way of thinking about it. So we're not about delivering evidence to professionals who are then going to be judged on how well they implement that evidence-based policy or that evidence-based practice. We're actually going to work with people to co-configure new kinds of teaching and learning practice. Actually, that does produce something that's sometimes called good mode two research. So it's not people where you just include the professionals as end users at the end. You deliver it to them and they do whatever they wish with it. You work with them throughout the process. So we think there was a possibility there. We also then come up with some actions at the end of the book. What should we do about this? As well as kind of having principles, we need to do something. So we said we need to create conditions for change through powerful arguments in the public sphere. We need to become as rhetorically adept as reformers. So this year, a number of my colleagues and I have developed something called Teacher Development 3.0, an organization underneath Teacher Education Exchange. These are us. They comprise head teachers, teacher educators at different universities. We produced, as a result of, there you see the word innovation again, innovation workshops for the Teacher Education Advancement Network. This pamphlet, you can download it free from that URL. We published it on the 26th of January, and by the 29th of February, we'd had 1,000 downloads. I think it's now about 2,500 downloads, and we've done seminars basically focused on university-based teacher, higher education-based teacher educators. We want to create this kind of conversation and these arguments within our field. And it is to try to kind of change the terms of the argument. So not in the pamphlet so much as in what we've written about it, we refer to the work of people like George Lakoff and Paul Lippmann, one coming from a field of cognitive linguistics, where a colleague was talking earlier this morning, how it was influencing his doctorate, the other from a kind of urban education thing. If you just respond, you argue on the basis of someone else's terms. How can you change the terms of the argument? These are our design principles. A long life teaching profession. We chose that rather than lifelong because it has connotations with milk. And people don't like it, but then they talk about it. So they talk about the fact long life isn't very nice. Schools, universities, and teachers at the heart of their community. Education as cultural and societal development as well as individual advantage. And a continuum of professional learning. These are the design questions we pose. You can download it free of charge. The second action we're saying is design professional learning around complex understandings of practice and have a better concept of evidence-based practice. And surprisingly, we're turning to medicine. But we think that very often when people turn to medicine, they don't always understand medicine as medicine. So we're particularly interested in primary healthcare, the kind of knowledge and the kind of expertise that your family doctor or your general practitioner has. not the person who does the highly specialized quadruple bypass. Yeah? And this Trish Greenhalgh is professor of primary care medicine at Oxford, and she talks about this process of knowing in medicine about collecting sensations and observations as a professional practitioner, getting data, interpreting those data in understanding, weighing up competing interpretations and evidence as judgment, and then choosing how to act. What is the right thing to do in this circumstance with this patient in front of me? That concept of deliberation. So from primary care medicine, we think this is actually a good model in terms of how should practitioners within education have an intelligent perspective on evidence in their practice. So, concluding, my personal position, I think that it is time for a change, and when I go around the world, I think I see that internationally. I am quite admiring and sometimes envious of these international reformers' energy, enthusiasm, ingenuity, and so on, and they're very rhetorically competent. I'm really at times despairing of the conservatism, the isolationism, the immunity to change, and the rhetorical disinterest of much of the university IT sector around the world, who seem to just quite reasonably, I suppose, if it was an individual activity, want to be left alone. But I'm also despairing of the hubris of these reformers. I think I'm certain that we do need to change, but and do so in non-defensive ways. I'm committed to the proposition that we need to get our relationship with the teaching profession right, but I'm skeptical that better data or better ways of generating data will solve our problems given the political nature of the evidence questions. So I'll end with a poem, a short extract from a poem by Ben Oakery, which is a kind of an injunction to change, and it was called Turn on the Light. You can't remake the world without remaking yourself. Each new era begins within. It is an inward event with unsuspected possibilities for inner liberation. We could use it to turn on our inward lights. We could use it even to dark. We could use even the dark and negative things positively. We could use the new era to clean our eyes, to see the world differently, and to see ourselves more differently. And the two words I think we really do need to interrogate more carefully are profession and university. Thank you.